If you're like me, you need to stay on top of what's working in events today. Whether it's your first time or you've been doing events for years, we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. We want to know what's working today. And to that end, I encourage you to check out Bold Push Plus. It's brought to you by Julius Solaris. He is one of the top voices and researchers in the events industry. Go to filmrashawn.com/boldpush, and that'll take you to a page that tells you more about it, and you can apply. If you would, put the name Phil and who referred you. That'll give me a little bit of money to keep this show going. Now back to the show.
I'm so excited to be here today with my friend and boss, Mike Stelzner. We've known each other for, I think, 18 years. Wow. Started out as friends. Mike was a volunteer at the school where I was business manager, and his kids went there. My kids went there. And then 2010, he gave me a chance to start doing some contract work, and I became an employee literally 13 years ago yesterday. That's May 1st, if we're in the future listening to us. But today we're going to be talking about social media marketing world, and Mike had the idea and I helped him implement it. So we're going to talk all about that conference. But Mike, I just want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Phil. It's great to be on the show and to talk about something that, man, we've been working together on for a very long time.
So go back in time. Mm-hmm. And you were at an event. You can tell us what event that was. Where did you get the inspiration to even do social media marketing world?
Yeah, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, inside the Renaissance Hotel. And I was going to be a speaker with Brian Clark from Copyblogger. And my good friend Joe Polizzi was putting on this event called Content Marketing World. It was the very first one. And there was about 300, 400 people there. And I saw him walking down the hall, and I had been to other events and spoken at other events. And there's just this calm demeanor about him. And I said, "What's going on, Joe?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Guess what? There are people you can hire to put on events." I'm like, "What? Are you kidding me?" So all of a sudden I took out my phone. I started taking pictures. And instantly at that moment, I knew that I was going to put on a conference. And he's like, "You're going to do it, aren't you?" And about a year and a half later, Social Media Marketing World happened.
I'll never forget the moment when you called me and you said, "Phil, I see a path to doing an event. And it's through hiring an event planner." I know we tried to hire that event planner, but she couldn't do it. So we ended up finding one. Yeah. All right. So fast forward, it was the next year when we really pulled the trigger and we started preparing to do it. Looking back, what's something you wish you had known about running a conference that would have made that experience different?
Well, the biggest couple things that come into my mind is, number one, how many people are going to physically show up? Because that, as you know, Phil, that's always the big question. And that's always the hardest question to answer. But I wish I knew that there were going to be that many people, because we ended up having like 1,100 people at the conference the first year, which was so much bigger than what I ever thought was possible, because I saw what Joe had done. And I'm like, okay, hundreds would be ideal. So knowing exactly how many people were going to be there would have been great to know. And then the other side of it is understanding how much we were going to need help. And help meant lots of things, but I do remember we were able to sit around one table at the celebratory dinner. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, like eight of us, right?
There's just a few of us, and like some of us had their spouses working it, you know, and I wish I would have known how much help we were going to need. And those are the things that I think are, you know, people underestimate how much work it's going to be. And they often have no idea how many people are really going to show up. And those are the two big stressors.
I mean, do you have any insight on how you could have guessed how many people were going to show up? Or is it really just a crapshoot?
We had one unique advantage, which is it started popping early and we knew that we did not have enough space. So as soon as we started selling tickets, we realized we need more stages. I feel like we might have expanded to 5 stages. Does that seem about right in the first year?
At least 4 plus the keynote, maybe 5. I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, we kept adding rooms because we realized there was not going to be enough space. So that's the good news, is that generally speaking, if you're pretty good with numbers and pretty good at projecting, you can kind of understand once you've done an event, you set a bar, right? And then you have an objective of trying to get bigger. And as you know, we had really humongous aspirations, which never really came true, but we had really big ones. And generally speaking, from that point forward, we almost always had more space than we needed.
Well, and a little, you know, event called COVID might have disrupted some of those growth plans. I want to back up for a minute because Joe Pulizzi, when I interviewed him, talked about something that was really important that I think is part of why we may have had such big numbers. And that's the fact that we had a huge community via email and social media. Is there any insight that you would give about that?
Yeah. Back when this was happening, most events relied on what were called media partners, and content marketing world was no different. And media partners were people that you would do trade arrangements with, where maybe you would give them promotion in exchange at the event, like their logo would be all over the sign. And we used to have our logo everywhere. Social Media Examiner's logo was on so many events, right? We were sponsoring them all. It didn't cost us anything. It was a trade. It was like a branding deal. And a lot of the secret advantage we had is we were an established media company. We had started in 2009. Our first event was in 2013. So that's like 4 years in the making. And we had a massive audience. And we had already established other marketing vehicles. Like I had launched a podcast that had become one of the top rated podcasts in the business category called Social Media Marketing. So I think the thing that we understood that most other events did not understand was the marketing side of it. Like, I think that was our secret sauce. We were already master marketers and we already had a loyal, committed audience. And our timing was really good too, because 2013 was as social media was kind of popping. You know, it was kind of like going through a burst of excitement. And it wasn't just a new thing anymore. It was a mainstream thing and it was growing. So I think we were in the right place at the right time with the right message, targeting the right people.
And we're coming out of the recession. So hotels were cheap and people wanted to travel. And there weren't a lot of competitors in our space back then. So let's just imagine, which this would be crazy to do, but if you were starting Social Media Marketing World this year for next year, is there anything different that you would do?
Is this a new question that you just came up with, or is this a question we had already planned? Because I'm just curious.
It is a new question in response to that.
Yeah. If I was starting brand new this year, is there anything different that I would do that I didn't do when I started 13 years ago? Yes. Or whatever it was. That's so hard to answer because like we've evolved so much since then. The thing that I would do today is the same thing I did back then. I would make sure that we had a very loyal audience that we had access to. It's harder to achieve today than it was back then. I would probably spend money on advertising today, which I did not do back then. And I don't do very much today either because we've got this legacy audience of people that gives us an unfair advantage. But I would definitely do ads. I would do Facebook ads. I would do Instagram ads. I would do YouTube ads. I would do whatever ads you can think of to try to get the message out there. I would probably hire influencers today to kind of promote the event. And when I say hire, I mean pay them. You know, not affiliate deals, but quite literally pay them. Those are the things that you almost have to do today in order to get your message out there.
One thing we didn't know in 2013 and we've grown into is the role of experience. And I would think if we were doing an event today, you have to be creating a great experience. So,
100%. 100%. But like I'm operating from the presupposition that they're just getting started and experience, I think, and I'd love to hear your thought on this, Phil. I feel like the experience layer is generally something that is ideal for events that have been around a little bit because that extra layer of care comes at a cost, right? And it's a substantial cost of labor or personnel or entertainment or design crews and production and all that kind of stuff. That's sometimes outside of the realm of possibility for a startup first year event, but I'm with you. It's a critical experience. When we did have that in year one with Mike Bruni. And for those that don't know what Mike did, is he convinced us to come on board as a ambassador, for lack of better words, where he was going to get people to connect. It was called hashtag to handshakes or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And what he did was he coordinated morning walks for people to walk around San Diego Bay. And he just encouraged people to effectively get to know each other. And from that was kind of born in a program of volunteers where their whole job was to help people connect. Does that sound about right, Phil?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And he convinced us to let him come.
Yeah.
He didn't ask to be paid. He just said, you know, would you give me a ticket? I will convince you that this is an important role. And that's something that grew over the years into a large team who understood the importance of helping people connect. And we've realized we don't have to have such a large team to make that happen. One other thing we did in year one, and I think we did start a lot of other things in year two and beyond, but we did have a live band. And that's become, you know, live music has become a staple at our event that differentiates us. Certainly my role in that has been important, but it sets us apart. And I think that doesn't have to cost a lot of money to figure out what can you do to make your event unique that's going to make people want to come back. Because I think experience, that's one of the biggest contributions, is it, you know, gets people to say, yes, I'm coming back, and they'll tell the stories. So
one thing that I always made sure that we had at our events from year one was exceptional networking. My presupposition at the time was that most events either have no networking, which means you just show up and you don't know anybody, or they have, and it's not even just no networking. Generally, they're so focused on the entertainment where you're in a dark room staring at a stage being entertained. And mm-hmm. I said, that's not the right kind of entertainment. What mm-hmm. I want people to do is be in a room that's not necessarily a dark room, but a lit room where they can get to know each other. And we also did something rather unusual, which was we brought Larry Binet in year one. And Larry Binet is known as the connector. And what he did was he got everybody up out of their seats to talk to everyone and make connections. So we intentionally had friends in our network that understood how to do this stuff. And we injected it into the beginning because we just knew most other events make it hard for people to connect. And I would say that eventually led to our table talks and all the other things that we've done over the years, because we realized that the reason they come is for the content. The reason they come back is because of the connections.
100%. Yeah, we ended up finding super connectors is what I call them, but people who can't help but introduce people to their neighbor. And we empowered them, and some of them we hired for certain years, but that has become bread and butter for the event. I want to move to a different question, Mike. So as I don't know if it was 3 or 4 years ago, you started hearing from long-term customers that they weren't coming back to the event. How did you respond to that feedback?
Well, let's talk about what happened. First of all, Social Media Examiner as a company shifted during COVID. During COVID, we basically could not conduct our event because the convention center turned into a homeless shelter. And as a result, there was a 2-year gap between when people were last at the event and when they came back. During that time, a lot of businesses ended up cutting travel budgets, and most conferences were sliced in half. Now, during that time, we kind of reinvented who we were and who we were for. And we made the strategic decision that our primary target audience was not going to be bigger businesses. It was going to be smaller businesses. We decided we were going to be for the small business marketer, the person working in the marketing department in a small business, or the business owner, or creators, meaning YouTubers, podcasters, video creators, writers. So as a result of that, coupled with the fact that our budget got slashed, we ended up only having three simultaneous stages. So I had to make the strategic decision to pare the content back to content that was going to be attractive to the primary target audience that we were trying to attract, which was not brands and which was not agencies. And when people came back, basically a lot of people loved it, but some people did not. And the ones that did not were partly strategically because it wasn't designed for them. However, I ended up saying to myself, okay, maybe the agency audience, because they're also small businesses, are someone we should have back. So I ended up hiring Brooke Sellis, and we launched the Marketing Agency Show. And the Marketing Agency Show was designed to draw that agency audience to us to see whether or not we could get them to come back to social media marketing world. Now, it turned out that the marketing agencies did come back, but we don't think they came back because of that show. What ended up happening is the following year, we decided to expand our content, add another stage to include some brand content and to include some marketing agency content. And we just tracked all the data very carefully. And it turned out in hindsight that we ended up not targeting the marketing agency this year crowd and not targeting the brand crowd. We instead just facilitated opportunities for them to connect through table talks. And this was, I think, our best year ever. So what sometimes you have to do is you have to understand that you can't always be what you were if you want to get somewhere new. And in the early days, Phil, you knew this, we were for creatives, creators, we were for everyone. And when you're for everyone, you end up having certain people say, I don't think these people are for me. And it's like, we decided to narrow that focus. And now I feel like we're in a really good spot.
Yeah. I mean, if we're honest, the first year or two, there weren't any competitors to us. So we needed to be for everybody. But eventually people popped up serving those other audiences that you're talking about.
And yeah, we had podcast track. And then, you know, now they have their own conference, right? And we
exactly
live video. We just covered, we had like 10 simultaneous stages at 1 year. We just realized we could not possibly be for everyone. And we were tracking the metrics and noticing how many people were in the rooms and all those things. And it's just really hard to try to satisfy everyone. And sometimes the more narrow the focus, the more successful you can be.
One thing I would just highlight that you've talked about is you pay a lot of attention to data, and you're following data, not just from the conference, but from all the media that we have. Do you want to just talk for a second about the things that you're looking at that other event owners might be paying attention to dictate the content and the experience they're creating?
Well, we have another unfair advantage is every 6 months we do a really detailed study of our audience, and we usually publish that in various reports. But it allows us to know who they are, what kind of business they work for, how big they are. And what we discovered is that we're really, for very small businesses, like 10 or less employees, overwhelmingly female audience, overwhelmingly interested in very specific things like Instagram and LinkedIn and YouTube. And it just became very easy for us to make our content mix be driven by the data. And the data has never steered us wrong. You know, like there's a direct correlation behind the studies that we put out every year. And we're about to release the 17th annual study, a social media market industry report, and the rooms that people go into. Like it's really crazy how accurate these things are. And sometimes there's new trends that pop in, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But, you know, for the most part, if you have access to data, it can really help you decide what kinds of topics you ought to have on your stage.
Now, there's one other piece of feedback we received a few years after COVID that people were saying, I don't know if this was in any of the data, but certainly you and I heard it anecdotally, and that is the energy seems off. It's not what we remember. The experience isn't quite what we thought. And so you gave me a charge. I don't know if you remember what you told me.
I don't.
You basically said, you'll take care of the content, but Phil, you need to take care of the experience. And so we went out and found Chad Peterson, who is a phenomenal person of creating experience. And I put my focus on that again. And we said, we've got to revamp it. And the next year, people said, on both accounts, we nailed it. And this year, I think we nailed it even more. But sometimes you have to listen to what the customers are telling you, even if it's painful, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy because I'm very rational and logically minded and not so emotional. So I don't put as much credence into that kind of stuff, right? But I know that this audience is mostly women. You know what I mean? And how they feel is really important, right? And as a marketer, I understand the feeling thing is really, really important. And I know that I can deliver on the quality of the content, but making sure that they trigger some of those other things that they're looking for, like connection and community, that is something that's a little harder to pull off. And the fun factor, I think, is really your secret sauce. You know how to get people to feel either entertained or to bring the right people around so that they do have fun. And when you couple all that together, you get a great experience overall.
Yeah, I live by Maya Angelou's statement, people won't remember what you said, they won't remember what you did, but they'll remember how you made them feel.
100%.
And so I think that's why we put emphasis on it. That's what gets them to come back. It, you know, doesn't necessarily encourage the learning, but it sets the environment where they're comfortable in learning. All right, this is a big one, Mike, because I know a lot of events over time become used to just repeating the rinse and repeat cycle. And we've been doing this event now for 12 years, technically 13, but 12 times. How do you avoid that rinse and repeat cycle where, you know, you keep that experience fresh, you keep the content fresh? And I know we've talked about some of that, but what else would you add to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have some very specific things to say here. The key from my perspective is the speakers. Too many events invite the same people back every single year. And you can tell sometimes because you look at the speaker lineup and you have to put yourself in a position of a customer. If you look at the speaker lineup and you recognize like those are pretty much the same speakers they had last year, for the most part, that's not going to necessarily motivate anyone to come. So what I do is I work very strategically to always have a new influx of speakers. This year, 50%+ of the speakers were brand new people. And in order to do that, that means you have to not invite people back. And it also means you need to have a really good system to like separate the wheat from the chaff, to separate the good from the great from the good, right? Because the great speakers are the ones that are not saying the same thing every year. They're the ones that are sticking around in the halls afterwards for 45 minutes, talking to people, encouraging them, answering their questions. They're the ones that don't just fly in and fly out. They're there for the entire experience. But they're also the ones that practice their craft. They have something new that they deliver every year. And because our event is unique, where it's 100% recruitment, there is no application. There never has been. And I recruit all of them. Every speaker knows at my event that there's no guarantee that they will get invited back. And what that does is it generates this desire to bring their best stuff to the conference. And that has worked like a charm every single year. Those people that don't bring their best stuff, no matter who they are put on a list of maybe not inviting them back. And what this does is it signals to the audience that there's opportunity to get on that stage, which is really important because at an event like our event, this is a bucket list for people to get on the stage. And there are three times as many, there's so many people that want to speak on that stage. You know that, Phil, way more than the number of people that we could actually accept on the stage. And I think that's the key to keeping it fresh, is to have fresh voices. And the other side of it is to bring young voices. You probably noticed, Phil, we had a lot of 20-somethings on the stage this year. And you and I, you know, I'm in my 50s. We're not young pups anymore. And we have friends and we love them. But, you know, you got to bring fresh voices. And sometimes that means new voices and young voices and diverse voices on the stage. And that's really hard for events to do if they don't have a system. And we have a system, which is a really good system. We have a very sophisticated system where we are always recruiting, always watching, carefully nurturing relationships with people, which is really hard for other events to do, but it is part of our secret sauce.
Well, let's be honest, you spend time not only in your podcast, but also watching other podcasts and other shows to find out who are those new voices. Because, you know, a lot of events have an application process, but we've both been to events where that's failed the event. Like, most people can create a 2-minute reel and a good description and convince you they're going to be good. And then they get
out of AI. It can make it sound amazing, right?
Right. And some of those people flop. I mean, I've seen those happen. It's like, why did they invite that person?
Most events that have an application process have what I would call a substandard speaking roster. They've got their A speakers and then they've got their D speakers and there's nothing in between. And that's why I think that what we do is amazing, because everybody here is B or above.
Actually, Mike, this is interesting. I don't know if you saw this, but 2/3 of our speakers got the equivalent of an A this year.
That's crazy, huh?
Almost all of them, except for maybe two, got a B or higher,
yeah,
which is absolutely stunning. It wasn't always that way.
Right.
We've worked hard. And one of the things we saw, because people are taking this so seriously, is 15 people, including several old time speakers, have come to me for coaching. And I know many of them are hiring other people for coaching because they want to nail it when they get on our stage, because they know it makes a difference.
Yeah. And we have 60 speakers this year. So that's like, you know, it's a lot. And to have that many speakers at that high of a caliber is not something that you can just invent overnight. It's an enormous amount of work that goes into it, but it's the key to getting people to come back. Because if you can get customers to come back, and we have 700 people coming back already from the 2,000 that were there, which is kind of unheard of. If you think about the percentage, it's ridiculous. And that's like an event company's dream, because like just makes life so much easier.
Absolutely. I want to pivot this next question a little bit from what we talked about before. We know that one of the biggest trends in the world of marketing right now is AI, and it's affecting things all over the world. I just have a friend he's the president of Goodwill, and he posted on LinkedIn that all 200,000 of their employees are being trained in how to use AI in their work, which I think is stunning for a nonprofit to take that forward thinking view. I want to ask you, how has AI affected the way we put on this event? What are some of the opportunities that others could use that we've discovered? You know, I know we'll be discovering more in the next 12 months, but what have you seen us do so far?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if people want to learn about AI, we've decided to put a lot of energy into that this year. And we launched a show a year ago called AI Explored. And I bring on the leading people that I can find to get into the how in the world do you put this to work. And because we did this, I kind of had an unfair advantage, because I'm talking to all these brilliant people. And we were able to do all sorts of things inside the company that I'm not going to talk about. But specifically to your question, here's how AI helped us at a very practical level. We had people inside of rooms at the conference who had clipboards and pieces of paper and pens, and they were writing out reviews on a piece of paper for the speakers, right? And all the things. And we just used AI to scan those and grab the text out of them. You know, it was as simple as just blopping them into Google's AI studio and asking it to write out the text. And it was a copy and paste job. It can read cursive, it can read messy writing, which is really cool. That saved us a lot of energy. Another real benefit that AI has been for us is on the marketing side of it. So what we did, and we have hundreds and hundreds of these, we took testimonials from our customers. We have them in a spreadsheet. We exported them as a CSV file, and we uploaded them into a Claude project. Claude is like ChatGPT. It's like a custom project, but it's Claude. C-L-A-U-D. C-L-A-U-D-E dot A-I or something. Inside of that project, I then gave, you know, Claude the instructions on who our target audience was and what the product was. And then I gave it a PDF of every single page of our conference website. Then what I asked it to do was I could just go in and I could say, write an email. And we did one of these for customer communications and one of these for promotions to people that might be customers. for the promotions that might be customers, we would say something like, write an email for about the speakers speaking in the paid marketing track and focus on the unique background that they have. And the AI was smart enough to know that who those speakers were and smart enough to pull customer testimonials from people that had been in those sessions, and in an instant created a really good email for us. And we could do this over and over again. Then we did the exact same thing when we actually emailed our customers. So for example, if we wanted to talk about our unofficial party that we have every year, I could just say, here's the location and write me an email. And it would pull a testimonial from someone that says the best stuff is the stuff that happens outside of the conference, you know, and then it would bada bing, write the thing and we were good to go. And I think that, you know, this clear communication is kind of what we care about in this company. And AI has allowed us to really dial in really precise, persuasive emails to both customers and non-customers that allowed people to get excited. And it could do it in minutes.
If you're willing, there's a story you told recently of don't trust too much in AI because it didn't do a perfect job, that there's got to be a human element. Are you willing to tell that story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. we have our industry report, which I mentioned earlier, that's dropping. And I took the PDF of it and I dropped it into an AI system and I asked it to proof it. And it found all sorts of problems. And I thought, oh, that's awesome. Then I was like, hey, John, our director of marketing, you know, why don't you just look at the ads in here and make sure they're fine? Everything else is good. He's all, well, do you want me to look at everything else? I'm all, if you want to. But John is he's got an eagle eye. And he started finding all these problems, like pie charts that didn't add up to 100%. Or the wrong year, like it was referring to 2023 versus 2024. And like all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, okay, we need to actually send this off to our copy editor, because I thought, oh, we don't need to use our copy editor who's a contractor. So just this morning I got back the document from the copy editor and she found like 50 other things that were wrong with it, you know, things that I would have never found. Sentences that didn't have periods on the end of it and all sorts of other stuff, right? So I wrote about this on the socials this week. And I said the moral of the story is that the human element still is necessary. And, you know, I was very transparent and I shared how I thought I was going to save time and money by not using the human element. And I realized, nope, can't do that. Can't do that. This is way too important. Still need the human element.
100%. But it did save time. It just can't do everything that we wish that it would. I'm never going to forget, Mike, we were sitting in a hotel lobby and we were preparing for this 25 event. And you were showing us how to use AI, ChatGPT, the audio function in particular. And it was a threat to me because you asked it to brainstorm ideas for our entertainment, I think it was. I don't remember the exact prompt that we were giving, but it gave like 20 ideas in a split second. And like, I could have thought of all those, but it would have taken me hours to come up with them. And I think that just highlights the power of brainstorming. But what it did for me, and once I got over myself, was it started to unlock possibilities because it sped the process up and then showed me other places that I could go where I might have come up with 10 or 20 ideas. Now I come up with 100 ideas. And because I can have a conversation and say, well, what about this? What about that?
Well, and I love the fact that it's great for verbal processors, which I think you and I both are. The fact that you can quite literally talk to it and it will talk back to you in a human sounding voice allows you to process really complex things that maybe you're not ready to move on or you don't know how to move on. And that's one of the powers of it, is that sometimes you need to talk things out and you're not prepared to talk things out with a person yet. And this can really help you process that.
And it's really honestly good at being a consultant. You can put it in that role and say, I want you just to be a consultant and ask me questions so I can get more clear in my thinking about this as opposed to telling you. So those are just a few things that those listening can do with AI. And let's don't give away all the secrets.
Hey, Phil, real quick,
yeah.
There was another trend I wanted to talk about that's not related to AI, if you're okay with me.
But, yeah, please.
So one of the trends that I see happening in the event space that I think a lot of people need to process is payment plans. And this is something that we strategically decided to do a couple of years ago because we knew, like, what was the risk? So what we do at Social Media Marketing World is we allow someone to have a 4-payment plan or a 1-payment plan. And the 4-payment plan is only like $5 or $6 more per payment than what it would be if they paid the whole thing. And we decide to sell this quite literally like a few weeks before the conference. And the risk factor is that someone could just use one of those off-the-shelf credit cards, right? And show up for a quarter of the price and never pay us. But I said to my team, well, first of all, when you're that close to the event, it's almost full price. And what have we got to lose? Let's run the analysis. And it turns out that by allowing payment plans, we almost had none of them not fulfill their obligation to the event. And it allowed us to provide creative financing to our customers. So now we provide 4 payment plans for every kind of ticket that we sell. And that's really important when you're in a time of financial uncertainty, which we are kind of in right now, where you've got a lot of people that don't know how these tariffs are going to impact their business. And we even allowed it when we sold tickets on location at Social Media Marketing World. It just gives kind of a lower risk opportunity for a small business or a solopreneur to just say, okay, since this is going to be broken up in 4 payments, I'm going to give this a shot. I feel like this is a big trend that's happening on expensive products that most events do not do.
Reactions? Yeah, I agree. It's been a game changer. And I think even the person that works for a company, that gives them some flexibility to say, you know what, I'm going to lock in this price and I'm going to hope that my employer will reimburse that first payment. But even if they don't, I can pass the other 3 on to them. And so it gives someone a chance to say yes. Because we also do something else that many events don't do. We have a gracious, generous refund period. Mm-hmm. I think it goes up to like end of October or something like that. It's like 5 or 6 months after the event. Yeah. So it's, most events don't do that either. So I think that's definitely a trend. And given our financial times, it's an important one.
Well, and just to clarify what you mean by that, we don't mean 5 or 6 months after the event is over. We mean 5 or 6 months. So we give people on location a smoking deal and the best price they could ever get. And then we give them the option to go all the way until October of that year to get a full refund. And our event is usually in March or April. So that gives them kind of a low risk opportunity to actually buy the ticket on location, hope they'll get reimbursed by their boss. And ultimately, if they don't get reimbursed, then we'll obviously honor the refund. And I can tell you that very few people, like at an event that has 2,000 people, I think the most refunds we've ever had is like 150. Which is next to nothing, you know? And obviously people have conflicts of interest where they cannot attend. And another thing that you can do that's a trend is to offer live streaming and recording with your event ticket. Because once the refund period is over with, if they can't make it, they now have a reason to still participate because they can participate remotely in the live stream and the recordings, which has helped us with our customer service things because people say something has come up and I can't make it. Can I forward my ticket to next year? We say, no, we don't do that. But the good news is you can still, because you bought the all access ticket, get access to the live stream and get access to the recordings. And 99% of the people are like placated by that.
100%. Yeah, I think we made a really smart decision too of combining the live streaming and the recordings into one product. That gave them the option of showing up live or just watching the recordings later. And many people do just choose the recordings later. So, 100%. All right. I want you to give a succinct answer to this because we could probably talk about it for half an hour. But looking back, what is the boldest decision that you've made about the conference and what did it teach you about risk and reward?
Well, Phil, it's a decision that we made for the conference that just happened about a month ago. So we made 2 decisions. Number 1 is I was at another conference called Vid Summit put on by Daryl Eves. And I was inspired to add another stage and just to build it and hope they will come. Okay. So we decided to go from 4 simultaneous stages to 5 simultaneous stages. I had the financial assessment done and I said, I just want to do it and trust that the people will show up. Okay. That's a risky proposition because to add another stage is expensive. It's production, it's more speakers, it's more travel for all the speakers, it's more staff, it's all the things, right? It's essentially expanding the amount of the conference by literally 25%. That's a big decision. I made the case. We decided to do it. I decided I would pay the cost if for whatever reason something crazy happened. Then I coupled, then what happened next, and by the way, that decision was made in September of 2024, and our event was in March of 2025. So then I made another decision, which was a crazy decision, which is to have an entire track dedicated to AI. And that was risky because I didn't know if the audience was ready for it yet, but I saw the trend lines and I hypothesized that they will be ready by the time the conference comes around. And then I did one more crazy thing, which is I decided to come up with a new ticketing type, which is the AI ticket. And I hypothesized that this AI ticket, which would be our most economical ticket, would serve as an anchor to sell the marketer ticket, which is much more expensive, and the all-access ticket. So here's what ended up happening. The AI track, the AI stage was our second biggest room. Because it turned out that the data proved that I was correct, that the AI was going to be hot. And we had a 700 seat room that we filled up mostly on day one. And it was a huge part of what is propelling us into the future. So that was like the biggest risk I think I've ever taken because there was no guarantee that all this stuff was going to align. And we could have ended up with a room that was mostly empty, but quite the opposite happened.
Yeah, and we weren't planning to talk about this, and I'll cut it out if you don't want to, but we made a different bold risk a few years ago where you were excited about Web3 and even put on a conference.
Oh, yeah.
And so do you want to talk about that for a second?
Sure. Yeah, well, all I can say is thank goodness for TwitchCon because that was going on at the same time. So I had this crazy, I had another podcast called Web3 Business. It was before that was called Crypto Business. And I saw the Web3 frontier as like the next big thing, kind of like what I see with AI right now. And I knew it could have a really big opportunity for marketers because of things like NFTs and community stuff that was going on in that world that I won't get into. So I made the bold decision to have a conference and we got a big chunk of the San Diego Convention Center. And I had this huge vision. And then something happened. This guy named Sam Bankman-Fried decided to do something illegal. He went to jail. The whole marketplace crashed. Nobody was interested in it. We ended up selling like 50 tickets to this event. You know, we might have had 100 people with staff there. And it was a financial disaster. We ended up losing like $400,000 on this event. And it got me to the point where I'm like, if I take a risk, next time it's going to be a very calculated risk. I need so much data to prove it, right? Like no more of this just following my intuition stuff. So that's why it was scary, right? When we did it this time. But the good news about this time, it wasn't a separate conference. It was injected into an existing conference. It was way more intentional. There was a lot of work, as you know, that went on behind the scenes to kind of get us in stages and steps to get ready for this. And it was for sure risky, but a lot more strategic this time around, which is why we did not have a repeat of what happened when we did that.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's a great lesson to everybody is don't be afraid to take risks, but learn from them. I think this time the risk was more calculated and it wouldn't have been as big of a loss because it would have been absorbed into the entire event, unless something happened where nobody showed up, like 50 tickets, which we can't imagine for something like social media marketing world, but you know, we could have a lot less than we expected. So that's awesome. Well, Mike, this has been a great conversation. In just a minute, we're going to do my signature sign off. But is there anything in summary that you would love to share with the audience?
Yeah, some key points are if you are putting on events, number one, data really is important. If you want more certainty about whether or not the topics you're covering are going to resonate with your audience, gather information, see what they're interested in, try to get new voices on the stage. You can coach these people, work with these people. And of course, AI can be a really big unlock for organizations that don't have a big team, which is generally what you're dealing with with a lot of events. And don't be scared. Just experiment with it. Try it and just see what happens.
Awesome. Well, here's what the signature sign-off looks like. I'm going to ask you right now for three words, at least one of the words, if you can make it emotional. And then I will play back a response to it on the saxophone, and then we'll bring the show to a close. So what are your three words?
Okay. It's experiment, AI, and feeling.
All right. This will be fun.
I don't know how you're going to do this. I can't wait.
I can't either. Here we go.
Nice job.
All right. I don't know if you heard the robotic element in there contrasted with the feelings, but I tried. So, Mike, tell everybody where's the best place to follow you online.
Well, socialmediaexaminer.com is where you can learn more about our company. And then I'm available on Facebook, LinkedIn, and or X. Those are my three top platforms that I'm on all the time.
All right. Well, I will provide the links for that in the show notes. Thank you again, Mike, for being on the show.
My pleasure.